And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we begin, though, I want to let you know about a unique ebook that's yours to download free today. It's called Googling God, and in it you'll find truth-filled answers to the top five questions people ask online about God. Googling God outlines core apologetic responses to life's deepest questions, helping you know why you believe what you believe. More importantly, it will prepare you to respond with confidence and grace to questions and objections that come your way as you live and speak for Christ. Download your free copy of Googling God today by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hi again, this is Justin Brierley bringing you your midweek dose of Unbelievable right up at the end of the year, a classic replay from our archives and another gem featuring Bible scholar Bart Ehrman. Now in this show, which was first broadcast in August 2011, Ehrman returned to talk about his book Forged with Darrell Bock of Dallas Theological Seminary. Now, Bart claims that many of the writings of the New Testament are falsely attributed to apostles such as Peter and Paul. And in this show, Bock responds to Bart, saying that the case for forgery is not as conclusive as he claims. I hope you enjoy listening to this one. For more from the regular weekend Unbelievable show, do check out our show page and loads of resources and more besides, and exciting plans for 2022 as well. That's all available at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Well, today on the show, we've got Bart Ehrman here in the studio, and he pops in from time to time when he's in the UK, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him back today. He was last with us interacting with Mike Licona on the resurrection of Jesus. Today, though, we're looking at his latest book, Forged. Were the New Testament writers not who we think they are? And we're going to be looking at some of the issues that have arisen out of that book. My guest on the line today from Germany is Darrell Bock, who's Research Professor of New Testament Studies at Dallas Theological Seminaries, author of a number of books as well. And I'm going to put links to both my guests on the website of the program today. You can also, of course, find many of Bart's books through his website. He's the James A. Gray Distinguished Professor of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, perhaps best known, though, in general for his book Misquoting Jesus. And, well, in many ways, Bart, I suppose it could be said Forged is kind of coming on the heels of what Misquoting Jesus did in terms of raising big questions about the reliability of Scripture. Obviously, Misquoting Jesus was talking about textual variation and whether we've received the New Testament documents accurately and that sort of thing. In this book, you take a different kind of approach. Tell us, what was the sort of thinking behind this book? What particularly drove you to want to write a book about whether the documents themselves are written by the people who claim to have written them?
Yeah, right. Well, first, thanks for having me on the show again. When I wrote Misquoting Jesus, it was at the end of maybe 20-some years of doing research on the manuscripts of the New Testament and how difficult it is for scholars to know what the original text said. So about 5 or 6 years ago, doing that kind of research for so many years, I got interested in another field of New Testament scholarship that I had known about for years and years but hadn't devoted myself to, which has to do with the authorship of writings in early Christianity. We have lots of books from the early Christian church, not just those of the New Testament. We have lots of Gospels and Epistles and Acts and Apocalypses. And most of these claim to be written by people who did not write them. The persons who wrote these books claim to be someone other than who they were. Usually they claim to be an apostle. And I got interested in this as a claim because in almost all instances, these people were lying about who they were. And so that's been a real interest of mine now for 5 or 6 years. I decided to look into what happened in the broader Greek and Roman worlds when people lied about who they were when they wrote books. And the thing that struck me most as a New Testament scholar is that scholars for a couple hundred years have been saying that there are books like that in the New Testament, that some of the New Testament books, in fact, are not written by the people who are claimed as their authors. And I thought it would be interesting to write a book for a lay audience, for a popular audience, about these books, mainly about the books in the New Testament, and whether they really are written by the people who are claimed as their authors.
Just as before we get into the technical discussions on this, and Daryl obviously is on the other side of this issue on today's program, what is there any motivation behind this, Bart? Because do you like to sort of put the cat among the pigeons? Obviously, what misquoting Jesus did was take issues that are well known in scholarly circles,
yes,
but put them very much in the public sphere. And I have a feeling a lot of Christians, church-going Christians, are sort of totally unfamiliar with this aspect of,
yes,
of their Bibles, and this may come as a real shock to many,
yes,
people that, hey, wasn't 1st and 2nd Peter written by Peter?
Yes.
You know? And
yes,
if not, who was it written by? What is your hope to kind of make them worry, doubt? Is it just to put the issue out there and make their own minds up?
Yes, I get accused a lot of trying to stir up the pot and making waves and causing problems, and actually it's not my motivation. My motivation is to bring biblical scholarship to a lay audience. So when I went to seminary, I went to Princeton Theological Seminary as a conservative evangelical Christian who believed that the Bible was the inerrant Word of God. And so I was a believing Christian who believed in the Bible. And the more I did my research at Princeton Seminary, the more I learned there, the more I realized that most scholars, in fact, have views that lay people don't know about. And it's always struck me as odd that pastors who go to seminaries outside of conservative evangelical seminaries, every other kind of seminary, Methodist, Episcopalian, Presbyterian, Lutheran, Roman Catholic, they learn things about the Bible that they don't communicate to their parishes, to their parishioners. And my motivation for writing books like Misquoting Jesus or like this book Forged is to make available to the reading public what students in mainline seminaries learn just as part of their education, because I think it's important if people revere the Bible, if they read the Bible, they should know what scholars say about the Bible. And so that's my motivation.
Well, let's introduce our other guest on today's program now. That's Daryl Bock, who, as I mentioned, is from Dallas Theological Seminary. He's Research Professor of New Testament Studies there. Daryl, great to have you joining us on the program today. Thank you for coming on the line.
My pleasure, and it's a pleasure to be here with Bart.
Well, Daryl, you heard sort of, you know, Bart's quick summary of his journey and where he's come to now. You, though, have grappled with these issues and many more besides. You're very familiar with all the issues that Bart has brought up in his book. For you, what do you make of what Bart is doing in kind of putting this stuff out to a more lay audience, a more popular audience? Helpful, unhelpful? Should Christians be worried?
Well, I actually think there is some value in what Bart is doing in terms of letting people know what the conversation is about the Bible among scholars. There is a huge conversation that's been going on in many cases on many of these issues for several hundred years. And having people be aware of what that discussion actually is and the rationale for it is helpful. Now, what happens is Bart produces his book, gives his reasons for why he thinks so many of the materials in the New Testament are not written by the authors who claim to write them. And then what often happens, someone else comes along and gives the other side of the discussion. And so what inevitably happens for people who are reading the materials is that they get one side of the discussion or the other normally. They don't get both conversationalists kind of talking to each other at the same time, and that's kind of the value of what you do when you bring us both together in the same room and say, hey, let's have a conversation.
Well, you're not quite in the same room, but it's good to have you both on at the same time. And I should say, by the way, this was arranged at somewhat short notice, but I wanted to make it happen. And my great thanks to you, Daryl, for stepping up at short notice to do the program from where you are in Germany. I think anyone who has a whole website devoted to debunking them, that has to be a kind of interesting sort of... They must be saying something quite interesting and provocative. And Daryl, you're one of the contributors to the airmanproject.com, which is a website, actually, that I'm sure you're aware of this website, but of various scholars giving their reasons why they feel the Bible can be trusted against some of your criticisms.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Okay, Bart, you've given us a kind of brief overview of the book, your intentions for writing it. Let's look at some specific examples, okay? I often quote a verse on this program, 1 Peter 3:15. Always be prepared to give an answer to anyone who asks you for the hope that you have, yet do it with gentleness and reverence. It would be quite annoying if I found out it wasn't actually Peter who wrote those words. But that is your contention, for instance, that 1st and 2nd Peter were not actually written by Peter. They've been ascribed to Peter. There's a reference within those letters to say that this is Peter writing. What are your reasons for thinking that those letters were not actually written by Peter?
Well, first, let me start by saying that the material I present in the book on 1st and 2nd Peter and in fact on everything is not based on simply my personal odd points of view. These are points of view that are widely held in scholarship. I'd say outside of conservative evangelical circles, they are fairly standard views. And so there's nothing that's going to be shocking or nothing that, for example, Daryl will have read and said, oh, I never heard that before. In fact, this is standard stuff. And so with 1st and 2nd Peter, the first thing to say is that there's far less dispute about 2nd Peter than about 1st Peter. The majority of scholars don't think Paul wrote 2nd Peter, including...
don't think Peter wrote 2nd Peter.
That Peter didn't write 2nd Peter, right? Including a good number of conservative evangelical scholars are just convinced that it's so different from 1st Peter when you read it in the Greek that it just looks like it's a different author. So, but there are people who think, I think Daryl thinks that Peter wrote both 1st and 2nd Peter, and I don't think Peter wrote either one of them. And the main reason that might be the most fruitful to focus on for us is that I think that, in fact, Peter, who was a lower-class Aramaic-speaking fisherman from Galilee, a rural area, did not have an education, as is true of the vast majority of people in the ancient world, and especially true in rural parts of the Roman Empire. There weren't schools in Capernaum, where he grew up. There were not places to learn. And whoever wrote 1 Peter, the verse you just quoted, is a highly trained, highly literate, Greek-speaking Christian who knows rhetorical techniques, who has a superb Greek vocabulary, and it simply is not the lower-class Aramaic-speaking peasant from Galilee who didn't know how to read or write. So a lot of people said, well, maybe he used a secretary. And so he told the secretary what to write.
Yeah, that kind of like dictating to your letters to your secretary.
Yeah, so I have a whole section of my book showing why that probably didn't happen.
Okay.
that we don't really have evidence that kind of letter writing technique happened in the ancient world. Hmm. So if somebody wants to appeal to a secretary, then I usually ask them what the evidence is.
Okay, great start. Daryl, firstly, do you agree with Bart's contention that the majority of scholars wouldn't find his views controversial, that what's sort of technically termed pseudography was common in, that various documents of the New Testament are not written by the authors that the letters actually claim they are?
No, Bart's right. There are many, many scholars who accept pseudepigraphy as a part of what goes on in the New Testament. The debate is just how widespread it is, how many books it actually impacts. I think it'd be fair to say that in Forged, as Bart says, well, he's taking very common positions, that in fact he has taken on really the maximal amount of Forged materials that are suggested as opposed to a more minimal amount that some people would hold to who would accept the theory.
So, for instance, with First and Second Peter, Bart says they're both not by Peter, whereas lots of scholars would say, well, I'm happy with First Peter, not Second Peter, sort of thing.
That's right. Or if we come to the Paulines, we would have a different range as how many people would accept, say, for example, Colossians or First Thessalonians or Ephesians would go back to Paul versus being written by someone who's claiming to write in the name of Paul.
Mm.
So in that sense, when he portrays the book as being reflective of the general discussion out there, this is actually part of my basic complaint about the book, is that he represents himself as taking on common scholarly positions when in fact it depends where we are in the book and which issue we're talking about. On Second Peter, he's quite right. Most scholars are arguing that Peter did not write Second Peter, and that is a very, very common position, and it is also a position among some evangelicals. But with regard to other books, it's much more controversial, and there's much more give and take, and there's much more debate, and the scale isn't quite tilted in the way that the impression of the book leaves. So that's one problem that I have. That's a general problem. Now let's come to the issue of Peter in particular and this idea of illiteracy for Peter and whether or not he would function in this kind of a context. One of the sources that Bart cites in working with this book is Catherine Hetzer's Jewish Literacy in Roman Palestine. Now, I hate to cite a technical work, but it's important here. Mm. And she is arguing that somewhere between 3 and 5% of the people have a high literacy rate in the culture. Bart states it's closer to 1%. So again, we've got this lean that I talk about that he writes with. But more importantly, she has other categories that he doesn't even mention that she discusses about the kinds of literacy that are going on. It's one thing to say someone is very, very technical with the language. It's another thing to say what someone might be able to do orally with the language. It also is another category whether someone has kind of a basic reading and writing capability as opposed to a high level. And so all these affect the percentages you put on the literacy rates of what we're talking about. And she talks about, in particular, in the culture, how tradesmen tend to be what she would call semi-literate and multilingual, and how secretaries, in particular, work with political and administrative kinds of documents, which are the kinds of documents that we have in the New Testament, that kind of thing. And so the impression that Bart leaves in the book, that this is just kind of a really clear case of asking for an illiterate to write something literate, I think pushes the scale too far to one side. What I see is someone who functioned not only in the land of Israel but outside the land of Israel as a missionary, traveled a lot, engaged a lot with people. Now, he either had to have someone who helped him do that, or he was capable of doing it himself. And so those kinds of impressions about Peter we don't even see anywhere in the book.
And just before Bart comes back, on the issue of him, the potential of him using a secretary that he essentially dictated, and the secretary was the one who, as it were, was able to form the Greek, etc. What do you disagree with Bart on that front?
Yes, I do. And again, here's another study that Bart appeals to. There's a work by Richards, which we both agree is the most detailed discussion of this. He has updated the work from the time or the material that Bart is using, and he's very clear that there is this intermediate level that Hetzer also mentions, where we get a figure who works in certain kinds of contexts and who has some type of a role. Why, you know, in fact, this book asks the question, why would you even employ a secretary at all and not use all the skills that a secretary can bring to their task in working with a letter? And there's agreement that there are people writing these texts for Paul in certain of these letters.
Mm. Well, let's give Bart a chance to respond, and feel free to now interact as we continue.
Yeah, guys. So let me say some things about literacy. Hetzer is basing her argument on an article by Meir Bar-Ilan, which argues that probably 3% of Palestine could function in terms of literacy. She's actually talking about reading literacy, and Bar-Ilan herself says not that 1% is literate, but that in some villages, probably 1% of people could read. Now, far fewer people can write than can read. These are separate skills in the ancient world, and so you have to ask how many people in an ancient place like rural Palestine could read and write. Well, suppose you go with the higher figure, 3 to 5%. Who are these 3 to 5%? Both studies are completely clear about this. These are urbanite people who live in major urban areas, who are among the elite, who are come from wealthy families, who can afford the time and leisure to train their children to read and to write. And so the question is, was Peter an upper-class, elite aristocrat from an urban area in Palestine? The answer is no. He was nowhere near any of that. And so what are the chances that he could read or write? The chances are extremely small indeed. One way to get to the answer is to ask ourselves, how many authors do we know from Palestine of the first century who wrote in Greek? I don't know, Daryl, if you know the answer to this, but I can tell you the answer. We know of one, Josephus. Of all of the many, many, many thousands of people, we have one author from the first century in writing in Greek. And Josephus says he couldn't write in Greek very well. He needed help.
That's only if you exclude some of the evidence that we're actually debating.
I'm saying exclude this evidence and just say we don't know about this.
How many actual sources do we have?
That's my point. Exactly,
we
because nobody wrote.
No, well,
if they did write, give me evidence.
Actually, there was a lot of writing done. We haven't been able to recover a lot of what's been.
What's
written.
The evidence of it?
Well. You can't. That's an argument from a kind of silence.
No, I'm not arguing from silence. You're saying there was writing there that we don't have, and I'm asking you what the evidence is.
No, I'm saying it's there. I'm saying we're disputing whether certain people who come out of this background actually have this.
Okay, name a non-Christian in Palestine who wrote in the first century in Greek.
Name
somebody that we know of from Palestine who wrote in Greek outside of the materials we're talking about.
Are we going to talk about books? Are we going to talk about letters? Are we going to talk about ossuaries? Because once you start to do that,
Whoever wrote a graffiti on an ossuary isn't the same kind of person who could write an epistle. So I'm saying
Not talking about graffiti on an ossuary. We're talking about political administrative texts. Part of what Hetzer studied was the whole mass of stuff that we have, not just letters, but business documents, that kind of thing. And what we see in this material is a range of languages. Fitzmyer wrote a famous article in which he was arguing for the distribution of Greek in the Holy Land, in which he showed a wide range of materials with people writing in Greek. Working with Greek language, working with Aramaic in some cases, working with Hebrew.
No, not writing in Greek. We don't have Greek texts from anybody in Palestine from the first century, apart from Josephus.
What is Hetzer talking about when she says that merchant and trade people give evidence of knowing Greek, especially in a political and administrative role, often tied to commerce and other tasks? I can give you the pages, page 94, page 243, pages 276 to 87 of her study.
Right. She's not talking about literary texts, is she? She's talking about documentary texts.
Well, let's make a distinction.
Yes, absolutely make a distinction, because it's a big difference between writing out a will and writing a literary epistle.
Again, depending on how you work with what's available, that may or may not be a great difference. If someone is trading in doing business in a given language, and they are able to work in Greek, we're just going to say, well, they can do that, but they can't write a literary text. They can't write a short letter.
Now, one point is that that these rural Galileans didn't know Greek. This has been shown fairly conclusively by Mark Chancy, that the idea that Greek was widely known throughout Galilee, in fact, is a modern myth, and that the ancient sources don't support it. He bases this on a study of every surviving literary reference to literacy in Galilee and to every surviving material remain, the inscriptions all the documents, everything we have, that, in fact, outside of the major urban areas of Sepphoris and Tiberias, people didn't speak or write Greek. They knew Aramaic. Peter, of course, didn't come from an urban area like Tiberias or Sepphoris.
No, but he interacted as a merchant in the Sea of Galilee area with people who did come from those backgrounds, and he did business, and I've already mentioned the
example. We don't know what kind of business he did.
How do you foresee him engaging in ministry when he moves outside the
land? I think
he
had an interpreter.
I mean,
he just traveled with an interpreter wherever he went.
Well, he certainly didn't know literary Greek.
I mean, what about the other plank of this, which is that did he use a secretary? Coming back to that, because in my very poor understanding compared to you guys' understanding of the letters, you even see it in some of Paul's letters, for instance, that it seems that at some points he says, "I'm going to write this with my own hand." It seems like people used kind of scribes, secretaries, and so what given that that's a possibility, why wouldn't a secretary have been able to write down the complex Greek?
So Randy Richards wrote this book, and he talks about all the various ways secretaries are used. I mean, Paul, for example, dictated to a secretary. Now, to dictate an oral composition requires education, just as writing a composition takes education. You have to be educated in order to do it. So I read through Richard's book, and he says that one of the things that secretaries sometimes did is they would compose a letter for an author. And I looked at what evidence he cited for this, and he didn't cite any evidence. And so I wrote him an email, and I said, "Well, Randy, I said, you know, you say that this sometimes happened. I said, did you find any evidence of it?" And he wrote me an email back and said, "Well, no, actually, there is no evidence of it."
There is evidence.
Oh, what's the evidence?
Well, Daryl, if I can ask you to,
if
I can ask you to hold that thought, Daryl, we have to go to a break, and so we'll come straight back into this, the issue of whether there is evidence for this practice of secretaries writing these letters. So you're listening to a fascinating discussion as we look at Bart Ehrman's latest book, Forged, and we're asking today, are the New Testament authors not who we think they are? And he's in conversation with Daryl Bock, who's Research Professor of New Testament Studies at Dallas Theological Seminary. I'm Justin Brawley, your host for Unbelievable Today. We'll be continuing in just a moment's time.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to Unbelievable. As we look at Bart Ehrman's latest book, Are the New Testament Authors Not Who We Think They Are? We're asking in relation to his latest book, Forged. He makes the claim that many letters and documents of the New Testament are what's technically called pseudographical works, not written by the authors that they claim to be. Well, is that true? We're asking today, were they even deliberately attempting to mislead the early Christians who were reading those letters? And indeed, misleading us today. And Daryl Bock, a research professor of New Testament Studies at Dallas Theological Seminary, is countering Bart. And I'm going to post a link to his blog, where he's written quite an in-depth critique of Forged. So that's all available at the Premier website of Unbelievable, premier.org.uk/unbelievable, with the podcast of this program. And, of course, a few programs that Bart's contributed to in the past I'll link to as well, for those who want to get their fix of biblical textual criticism and that sort of thing. Daryl, I had to interrupt, and I'm sorry for that, but Bart has said there just isn't good evidence of this practice taking place.
He said any evidence originally. Mm. Now he was in the process of explaining, and we should probably let him do that, the evidence that was being brought forward, or at least was put up. So let's let him do that before I respond, because I think that's only fair.
Yeah, thanks. Cicero mentions an incident in which Cicero is a first century Roman, very famous author who wrote a lot of letters, and he mentions one incident in which he was a friend of his, Atticus, was asked to write a full account of what had been going on in Rome for Cicero, and Atticus says that he was too tired to do it, and so he had a secretary do it, and this is sometimes used as evidence that sometimes someone would ask someone else to write a letter and sign their name. Mm. So, but when you look at what Cicero actually says, he doesn't say that when Atticus asked his friend to write it, that Atticus asked him to write it and then sign his, Atticus's, name. All he says is that he asked his friend to do it. Mm-hmm. So we don't know whether what his friend did. I mean, we assume that he wrote the letter in his own name rather than Atticus's name. At least that's the conclusion that Richards draws. So that's the one exception that he cites, and then he says that exception doesn't actually apply. And so then he says, so really, that's the one instance. But yet he keeps the category of sometimes people would write in someone else's name with their approval.
I think I noted when we discussed this earlier that that Bard's working with an early version of what, or earlier version of what Richards has done. He's updated his material and he's added more. He's added examples. I don't have them in front of me, but he has added examples to this category that he's talking about.
Are you talking about his new book, or are you talking about a new edition of the old book, or the second book?
I think it's a second edition of the original book, and because it was just done a few years ago, and the version that you have cited in your book is older, and so he has I think updated the evidence here, and goes through a handful of examples, some involving Cicero, and I believe there are a few others as well. To talk about this category of where the person works with the style of what it is that someone is writing and crafts the letter in light of conversations with the person that they're working with.
I would like to move us on, Jensen. I'm sorry, because we could keep going on this one for a while, I'm sure. But in a sense, I mentioned just a little while ago there, but Paul, and in a sense, that's where a lot of this material lies, whether Paul was the writer of a number of letters found in the New Testament. I mean, first of all, let's be clear, you're certain that Paul did write certain letters, aren't you? Could you name a few that you would quite happily say Paul was the writer?
Yeah, scholars normally talk about the seven undisputed Pauline letters, which would be Romans, 1st and 2nd Corinthians, Galatians, Philippians, 1st Thessalonians, and Philemon. Mm. So those are undisputed. It's not technically true, because there's always some person going to dispute this area.
But basically, everybody
agrees with the seven.
Consensus, yes.
And Daryl is absolutely right what he said at the beginning, that there are more debates about some books than others, and I'm sorry if I didn't give the impression that's the case, because it's absolutely true. Far more people think that Paul did not write 1st, 2nd Timothy and Titus, for example, the pastoral epistles. That it's fairly widespread among scholars outside of the conservative evangelical ranks that Paul did not write those three letters, and there are more debates about Colossians, Ephesians, and 2nd Thessalonians.
And so with those pastoral epistles, would even the recipient be a made-up person? Would this
probably
be a sort of, you know, kind of...
It's a double pseudepigraphy.
Yeah, in that sense. Yeah. I mean, and what are the reasons for thinking, for instance, let's talk Ephesians. Why can you look at Romans and say, yeah, Paul wrote that one, and then look at Ephesians and say, that's not the same?
Well, the logic scholars use is that if you've got seven letters that you're pretty sure... Paul wrote.
And why would you be sure he wrote those?
Well, it's complicated,
okay.
but it ends up being that they agree enough in terms of writing style, in terms of theology, in terms of historical situation, that they all appear to go back to the same person,
okay.
And the others differ. Okay. So if you take something like Ephesians, what you do is you have these seven letters, and you compare this other one to the seven and see whether it coincides well enough to think that the person really wrote it or not. And so you look, the major things you look at are, is the writing style the same? You know, people write in different styles. And so when you're reading Mark Twain, you know you're not reading T.S. Eliot. I mean, these are they're different writing styles, apart from the subject matter. You look at the theology. Are the theological views consistent with what is found in the seven undisputed letters? So writing style, vocabulary, theology, presupposed historical situation. You look at you do it the way you would do anything. If you found a letter by, say, Mark Twain, that somebody says is from Mark Twain, then you'd compare it in these ways.
Now, Daryl's going to kind of contest that whether Ephesians, for instance, was not written by Paul. But just staying with your kind of line of thought there, Bart. Why would someone make up that they were Paul writing a letter like Ephesians? And forgive me if I'm wrong in this, but isn't Ephesians sort of supposed to be one that was written from prison, as it were? So it's quite sort of contextualized within sort of, you know, I'm here in chains and all that sort of stuff.
Yes. So that is really one of the compelling questions. If somebody else wrote it claiming to be Paul, why would he do that? And so what I do in one part of my book is I talk about what the motivations were for forgery in the ancient world generally, since we have lots of examples from the Greek and Roman worlds, Jewish examples, pagan examples, and Christian examples that everybody agree on. You can make a kind of a taxonomy of motives, categories to slot them in. And in most cases with these early Christian writings, what's generally thought is that whoever was writing a book, Say Paul did not write Ephesians, say someone else did, why would somebody claim to be Paul? They'd claim to be Paul because they were a nobody. Nobody knew who they were. They had no authority, and they had a message that they thought was really important. And they probably thought this is something Paul would have said if he had been here. They might be right about that. They might be wrong about that, but that's probably what they thought. And in order to get their book read, they didn't claim to be John Schwartz, whom nobody had ever heard of. They claimed to be Paul. And that way people would read the book.
Okay. Daryl, do you want to interact with both aspects, you know, whether Ephesians, why you feel Ephesians doesn't, you shouldn't discount Ephesians as for coming from the hand of Paul, and whether this practice was widespread and could have crept into the New Testament?
Well, the practice was widespread. There's no doubt about that. And in fact, Bart's book in several places shows how widespread the practice was. The question is whether Christians in the community making a case for their theology, talking about honesty and integrity and those kinds of categories, would do something like this. The other issue that's in the background is, you know, how do these letters get to be circulated in a part of the tradition? Nobody writes it. They send it to a church. It's accepted by someone else coming from Paul, but we haven't asked the question, you know, how do you actually post a letter in the ancient world? And what kind of authentication comes when sending a letter from point A to point B? Those kinds of questions that would even allow the community that receives such a letter to even think about or consider, well, maybe this is Paul and maybe it isn't. We haven't discussed that at all, but that's an important part of the background. We haven't discussed things like when you look at the vocabulary, for example, in relationship to Ephesians, where we're told that there are 41 words not found elsewhere in the New Testament, and there are 84 not found elsewhere in Paul, and so vocabulary becomes one of the elements in the argument. We don't ask the question, well, what do the numbers look like for Galatians? Well, there are 35 words not found elsewhere in the New Testament, and there are 90 not found elsewhere in Paul, and yet no one disputes the book of Galatians as going back to Paul on the basis of vocabulary. So these arguments are presented, but they also cut both ways. And sometimes they're presented as if they make a clear case, when in fact they don't make as clear or compelling a case as is sometimes suggested.
Can I just say about that? I don't recall that I used a vocabulary argument for Ephesians. Maybe I did. But there are other reasons. Can I just say, though, about one point you made, you know, why would Christians do something like this, you ask? But in fact, we know that Christians did do things like this. We have lots of materials that are not in the New Testament that also support all sorts of ethical values by people who are lying about their identity. So it's not a question whether Christians would do something like this. Christians did do things like this. The
question is, what we're talking about in terms of these later some of these later documents is related to the development of, and this is going to get us into the whole probably background of how diverse Christianity was, but has to do with moving into a polemical direction in which the more the proto-Christian, if I can use that term, since we could debate, you know, what we mean, but the point is that which became known as Christianity existed, and there were people reacting to that, and they were making claims about revelation and experiences to trump and to challenge what was being said in the church that was making claims to have apostolic roots.
Yeah, but I'm thinking about completely innocent letters like the letter to the Laodiceans, which has no heresy axe to grind. It doesn't seem to be supporting any particular point of view. It's somebody claiming to be Paul who absolutely was not Paul, and so.
But the church didn't recognize that letter.
Well, no, but large portions of the church did recognize it. It continued to be printed in Latin Bibles in the West for centuries. It was considered canonical scripture by a large portion of the church for a very long time.
The letter to the Laodiceans?
Yes.
Well,
it's in Latin Bibles today.
We might get into a debate about what is meant by that phrase, but that's probably getting too technical.
Tell us then, Daryl, in a sense, for Ephesians itself, you feel that you don't have to go as skeptical as some scholars
for example,
do go.
There are claims made that there's teaching in Ephesians that Paul wouldn't write or that Paul wouldn't say. And there are two points to make here. One is the idea that sometimes when I read these works, I have the idea that Paul is a very static theologian, that he can't develop his thinking in any direction, even though he's recognized as one of the most creative theologians of the first century. So that's the first point to make. The second point to make is that, in fact, in many of these cases where we get the claim that Paul doesn't say X, in fact, we can find that he says something very much like X. He may not use the exact terminology, but he certainly works conceptually in the same kind of world. So, for example, we get claims about what Paul is capable of saying about being carried away by the lust of the flesh in Ephesians 2:3, and we can contrast the negative view about what what Ephesians says there with what Paul says in Philippians 3:4, that he was blameless with reference to the law. And so the claim is, well, those two things don't match. Well, in fact, you see Paul blaming every Jew in Romans 2 and 3 for falling short and for being hypocritical. So he's quite capable of saying those kinds of things. Or we get the idea that that saved is only a future tense idea in Paul, but we miss in Romans 6 the picture of being brought to new life and the picture of baptism in the first 11 verses of that chapter. So these claims that Paul couldn't say X have two problems. One, Paul can't develop his theology or express himself in certain ways or with a certain amount of diversity. And then secondly, and perhaps more importantly, we do have examples in the epistles that everyone suggests of Paul saying very much the kinds of things that is being said he couldn't say or didn't say.
And any response, Bob? To...
Yeah, I just think, of course, I agree that that Paul's theology can change and that Paul sometimes can contradict what he said at one point or another, and that in one place if he says that Christians are not raised with Christ yet, and some place else he says Christians are raised with Christ, if you want to admit that Paul just contradicts himself, that's fine. But another option is that Paul didn't write both things.
That's precisely the kind of example, the way of stating the issue that I think has problems in and of itself. Because when Paul says there isn't a resurrection, or Paul says there is a resurrection, depends entirely on the context in which he's addressing and the kind of opponent or view that he is dealing with. On the one hand, you have people in Corinth who are claiming that the full salvation has taken place, if I can say it that way, and that the resurrection has already taken place. And in those kinds of contexts, he's making he's making points about the return of Christ and the rest of salvation that leads to more restrictive language. But in other cases, he's quite content to say we're already raised. In fact, some people think that the reason why he's got problems in Corinth is people have misunderstood some of what he's already taught. That's not a case of him contradicting himself. That is a case of him engaging the theological view that is causing him to express himself in the way that he is.
Yeah, no, that's certainly one way to look at it. I mean, I think that what's happening in Ephesians is that Paul is taking precisely the position that the author of Ephesians is taking precisely the position that Paul is arguing against in Corinth, that the author of Ephesians imagines that the people, that Christians, have already been raised with Christ and are enjoying the benefits of salvation now, and that that's the position Paul is against.
But doesn't that fit the entire already not yet structure of New Testament theology? I mean,
it's a balancing act, I think. I think it's a balancing act. I mean, I think you do the same thing. No, it's not. Of course, people argue about it, but my point is, you do the same thing when you decide that Paul did not write 3 Corinthians.
Third Corinthians being a letter that was not included in canon.
It's not included in the New Testament. I'm sure Daryl thinks Paul didn't write it, and if I asked him for his reasons, he would probably say things about how the theology is different from Paul, the situation is different from Paul, the writing style is different from Paul. So
yeah, we're going to agree on the kinds of things that you look at to try and make these kinds of judgments. And there are many places in the book. I probably should say this. There are many places in the book where I actually agree very much with the line of argument that Bart has taken in arguing for the circumstances of certain books. There are also places where he takes a view outside the New Testament where I disagree with the judgment that he's made. But we are all using these factors. But my fundamental complaint here, or at least, and it's not much a complaint against Bart, it's a complaint about the way we have these discussions, is that what happens is that each person writes their book putting in their point of view, and what tends to happen is, of course, because each person is making the case, there is certain evidence that is put on the table, but there's certain evidence that the book itself doesn't engage, or doesn't engage quite so directly. So what do you have to do? You have to go to the other voice. Well, the problem there is that they often do the same thing in reverse for the case that they're making. And so then the problem for the reader is, because after all, our goal here when we started out was to say, well, let's help the layman understand these discussions, is that they're forced to do 2 reads that really actually never directly engage one another because they're each making their own case.
It would be good, just briefly, because there's other things I'd like to discuss before we run out of time, but for instance, 2 Thessalonians. Now, you've already mentioned that 1 Thessalonians, you're happy as being Pauline. Is that right?
Yeah, you said.
But 2 Thessalonians, which appears to be, on the face of it, a kind of follow-up letter to the church in Thessalonica, is not Pauline. Very quickly, bullet points. What are the reasons for that one, for instance,
Let me just say, part of the complication with this conversation and with my book is that we're trying to do this for a lay audience, and in fact, the arguments are complicated.
Of course.
So I've just finished,
they are, yes, that's true.
I've just finished writing a much, much longer book for scholars where I deal with these issues and go into considerable detail, but it's not the sort of thing that is going to work on the show.
Of course.
So the basic thing with 2 Thessalonians is part of the problem is when you put it in kind of basic terms, it's quite easy to undermine that with a counter argument. But here it is. The basic thing is that the understanding of the end times in 2 Thessalonians seems to be different from the understanding of 1 Thessalonians. That in 1 Thessalonians, Paul tells these people that Jesus is coming right away. He's going to come like a thief in the night. It's going to be sudden. It'll be unexpected, and they need to be ready for it. Mm-hmm. In 2 Thessalonians, he details an entire scenario that, no, it's not going to come right away. First this has to happen, then this has to happen, then that has to happen. And so don't be put off by thinking that it's going to come right away. Mm. And that seems to be contradictory.
Just, again, briefly, if you would, Daryl, a response to that.
Well, 2 parts of it. I mean, obviously, they're dealing in Thessalonica with what's going on at the end, and Paul is responding to that. In the first letter, he gives a generic response, really to reassure them about the fact that, no, they haven't missed out. The second coming hasn't happened yet. Everyone's going to participate, including the dead. The promises that have been made are going to happen. Then a second letter happens. What often happens is, in a second letter, you go into more detail about what you really think, because the first letter didn't completely take care of the problem. And I think that's what's going on in 2 Thessalonians. That's why you get more sequence. You do have in the early church this tension between coming soon and yet not so soon, that other things may occur or other things may happen. And here, when we start to enter this discussion, we'll get into a discussion of what goes back to Jesus, perhaps, and what may be a reflection of the early church in some of these texts that relate to the second coming. But just to give one example, in Luke 18, there's a terrific emphasis on how soon justice is going to come on behalf of the disciples. But in the same breath, there's the remark of, will the Son of Man find faith when he comes back, which tells you that it's long enough and problematic enough that some people are not going to have faith by whatever time it happens. And so these tensions are part of what we see in the interaction. Another argument that is sometimes made with regard to Thessalonians is that the perspective of 2 Thessalonians is so developed that it reflects a later period. But what the 10 in Thessalonians is telling us is that people are trying to sort this all out, and most people do accept that 1 Thessalonians is Pauline, and that he's dealing with these issues in the 50s. And so, that's the other half of the conversation.
Obviously, and we're all about bringing both halves of the conversation together on this program, and it's great to hear you kind of going at it together in this way. These are extremely technical issues when you really dig into them, and so I'm not expecting us to kind of, in any sense, hammer it out in that detail on this show. But it does bring us, to this more general point of the fact is, Daryl, that there are other evangelical scholars who are prepared to kind of give Bart the fact that pseudography exists, and so for instance Ben Witherington has done another detailed sort of look at Bart's book, Ben Witherington the Third. I love the fact that Americans can do the third, and we don't get that over here in the UK so much, but I think that what Ben Witherington would contest Bart is that it has quite the same level of impact that you say it has, that it was a kind of accepted practice, that there was, if you like, a school of teaching that was being represented when someone called themselves Paul.
Yes.
And so we shouldn't see this as a deceptive thing. This was simply just sort of, you know, the way that things happened at the time. And obviously you're making a stronger claim in that in the book, that this was really actually deception.
Yes, I am. I used to have Ben's point of view for years. I used to teach my students this, that it was common in philosophical schools for a student to write a book and sign his teacher's name to it, because the teacher's the one who gave him all his ideas, and that it was a perfectly acceptable practice. And I thought that until a few years ago, when I decided to look up the evidence for it. And what I found was Christian author after Christian author, commentary after commentary, saying this, but nobody citing the evidence that this happened in the ancient world. Now, I finally found some authors who talked about the evidence, and so I looked up the evidence, and it is virtually non-existent that in the ancient world this happened in the philosophical schools. The evidence has to do with the Pythagorean schools in particular, and one particular Neoplatonist author named Iamblichus, who says it happened. He's writing 800 years after the school that he's talking about, and he shows no evidence of knowing what he's talking about, so much so that the Pythagorean scholars say that, in fact, this isn't true. If somebody says this was a common practice, my response is always, show me the evidence.
We're going to get your response to that, Daryl, in just a moment's time. Sorry to have to cut in again. Do join us on the other side of a short break as we get response from Daryl and a sort of start to sum up our thoughts on today's programme. We've been asking today, are the New Testament authors not who we think they are? That is the central thesis of Bart's book, Forge, and even goes further than that to suggest that there was a deliberate attempt to mislead the early Christians by claiming authorship that simply wasn't true. And if you want to get hold of Bart's book, links, of course, with the website of this program, also to Daryl's work as well, and some of the links to his critiques of the book there as well. premier.org.uk/unbelievable.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, time to wrap up our discussion today on Bart Ehrman's new book, Forged. Thank you, Bart, for joining me in the studio today. It's been really interesting to have you here and Daryl on the line from Germany. Daryl Bock is Research Professor of New Testament Studies at Dallas Theological Seminary and a great blog as well, and tends to write on all sorts of things in the area of New Testament studies. If you want to check that out, it's blogs.bible.org/Bock. Again, links to both my guests on the website though today. Before we get to a kind of summing up from you both, gents, we just had to cut in there, Daryl, and I asked Bart why he adopted this position that there was real deception going on, even if you accepted that there was a sort of practice that there are pseudographical texts in the Bible. I mean, obviously you're not taking that position. You feel that Bart hasn't firmly established that the works in question are pseudographical, but obviously there are other scholars you respect who do take that position. Do you think Bart makes a good enough case for the fact that real deception was taking place and that this wasn't...
I think in many cases I actually agree with him, that I think that this is an attempt to deceive. It's often an attempt to use the name of a luminary to give credibility to a work that otherwise wouldn't have it if you knew who the real author was. There is a tweener category that we haven't discussed at all that's kind of more difficult, and that is, what do you do when you represent the theology of someone as being from them or sourced in them, even though you do the writing, but the ideas are really a reflection of the theology of the person who originally wrote, and you write in their name because you belong to their school. Now, this is like the Pythagorean example that he was using, but I think it's an important tweener category. I know of an example in my own lifetime in which someone wrote and updated a work and abridged it. Bart will appreciate this illustration, I think. Lewis Sperry Chafer was the founder of Dallas Seminary, wrote a long work on eschatology. Well, John Walbert updated his material and reduced it down in an edited form with Roy Zook, but they continued to present it as Chafer's theology, even though the writing and the words now updated and discussed, including some issues Chafer didn't directly address, but Walbert felt like, well, this is what Chafer would have said, ended up being in the material. And so when you get someone representing someone else who feels a debt to someone, then that's a kind of tweener category. Then I think it's a little harder to say this is outright deception, because the thought and the impetus for what's being said is coming from the person who you're giving credit to.
Do you want to respond briefly, Bart, and then we'll come to this?
Yeah, I agree. There are nuances and complications. What I'll say about early Christianity is that sort of thing did happen a lot, but what happened is that people claiming to be representing Paul's theology took absolutely opposite points of view about that theology. And so you had people, for example, forging works in the names of Paul who were Marcionites, and they said, we're simply representing what Paul thought. And you had Gnostics who wrote books in the name of Paul saying, we're just representing what Paul really thought.
I'm not talking, what we're now doing is moving into a whole area of how Paul's name is being used polemically, and in some cases, I think, would be a misrepresentation of what we actually know about what Paul said. That's a different kind of example than the example I'm raising, where we're talking about someone who is trying to represent and, if you will, extend what Paul said as opposed to contradict him. So I think we have to keep those categories somewhat distinct.
Yeah, but the problem is that these people didn't think that they were doing it polemically. They thought they were really doing what Paul would have said if he were alive in this situation.
How can you be a Marcionite, reject the Old Testament, and think that you're doing what Paul's doing?
You mean you think all the Marcionites thought that they were wrong?
I think the Marcionites, who argued, who rejected a whole lot of the Old Testament, couldn't have worked with Paul, who has the Old Testament chopped through all his writings.
They certainly did work with Paul. Paul was their hero. They thought that your view about Paul's view of the Old Testament was wrong. I know about the Old Testament, but they thought that Paul rejected the Old Testament because the letter kills and the Spirit gives life.
How can they do that and read Paul never under the Old Testament talk all the way through?
Right. In other words, if they disagree with you, they knew they were wrong.
No, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that Paul is using the Old Testament all the way through. He's talking
they don't
about
think he did.
They think he chucked it aside and didn't use
yes.
it?
Yes. You know about the Marcionites.
He cites the Old Testament.
Those were interpolations in his letters.
Scripture?
Yes, those were interpolations in his letters.
They won't use it as scripture?
Yes, because those were interpolations in Paul's letters.
That's what they said. My point.
They were honest. They were honestly doing what they thought was right. To say otherwise is not to do history, it's to do theology. Now, you may want to do theology instead of history, but I'm talking about history.
Well, unfortunately, when those two things are brought together, you can't split them apart like that. How you can have an author who writes a Romans or a 1 Corinthians or a 2 Corinthians, the letters that we accept, running through the depth of the kind of argument that you're talking about in the Old Testament and have someone say, oh, that's all interpolation. That really doesn't come from Paul. That's what the Marcionites did with Luke, okay?
But they did it in good conscience. It's not that they thought they were wrong.
I'm gonna draw a close on that one, guys, because it sounds like we could be going on that one for a while. But I want to thank you both for coming on the line. Firstly, Daryl and Bart here in the studio. Okay, Bart. At the end of the day, you feel that this is where the evidence points. I guess you feel, you know, as we sum up, that Daryl is perhaps defending essentially a view of inerrancy, or that he obviously has reasons for what he believes. He's got the evidence, but you feel is it because he's coming from a particular viewpoint that he's defending?
Yeah, well, deep down, that's what I think, is that the only people who really deny that there are any pseudepigraphy in the New Testament are people who have theological reasons for denying it. You won't find anybody, for example, in Daryl and my country, you won't find anybody teaching at a non-conservative evangelical school that takes that line. It doesn't matter what school you go to. You can go to Ivy League schools, Princeton, Harvard, Yale, Brown. You can go to major universities, North Carolina, Florida, Kentucky, Kansas, Texas. And you can go to private schools. You go anywhere. Anybody teaching anything about the New Testament who is not a conservative evangelical thinks that there are pseudepigrapha in the New Testament. The only people who say that there are not are conservative evangelicals, and that's not an accident. It's because there's a theological reason for saying that there aren't pseudepigrapha. And I understand the theological reason, because these people who wrote pseudepigrapha were lying about their identity and trying to deceive people. And if the Bible is the inerrant, inspired Word of God, you can't have people lying in it.
Thank you for joining us today. Daryl, obviously that's a big statement for Bart to be finishing with. Are you defending it because of the fact that this would seriously create a theological problem? And Bart's already accused you possibly of doing theology rather than history when it comes to the way you look at these books.
Well, I think the problem is again, we see in Bart's summary an oversimplification of what is going on. I think in fairness to him, that it's true that many people do defend this because they have a theological viewpoint. The question is how they come to that theological viewpoint and whether or not they, in their own thinking, have worked through the rationale for believing that. My story is the exact opposite of Bart's. I came out of a non-Christian home and came to a more conservative theological belief because I think that is what I see in the materials and the arguments that are put forward that people find, in some degrees, argue are so compelling, I'm trying to suggest are not as compelling as people are putting forward. In fact, there are real serious problems with some of the arguments. And those problems undermine the case that is being made. A lot of people who end up in universities actually have an anti-theological axe to grind, And so the same bias, if you will, that he's accusing me of can be placed on many people who are teaching in the humanities in their reaction to religion.
It's been fascinating having you both on, gentlemen. Thank you both for what's been a technical in some areas, but also really interesting sort of aspects that have been drawn out about the motivations and justifications for why these kinds of debates take place. So thank you, Daryl. Daryl, Research Professor of New Testament Studies at Dallas Theological Seminary, joined us on the line today. I hope perhaps we'll get you on again at some point in the future, Daryl.
I'd love to do it.
Great. And Bart, thanks for coming in today.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Do hope you enjoyed this week's Blast from the Past, our midweek classic replay. And for more from Unbelievable, including blogs, videos, an archive of past shows, and of course our plans for 2022, do check out the show page at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
American Giant makes great clothing, t-shirts, jeans, and more right here in the U.S., creating jobs in towns and cities across the country. Support America's workers and get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.